It really is hard to believe that 100 years ago, women in this country did not have the right to vote. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us again on the Ideas Network. With us by phone to talk about the women's suffrage movement is Kate Clark LeMay. She's a historian and coordinating curator of the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative. She's director of the National Portrait Gallery's Scholarly Center at the Smithsonian Institution. She will be talking with us about the movement and its leaders and the new book that's based on the Smithsonian's current exhibit, Votes for Women, A Portrait of Persistence. Fascinating book, and I'm looking forward to talking with her. And I hope you'll join in the conversation. What questions do you have about women's suffrage? What inspires you about the movement? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Kate Clark LeMay, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So the very timely exhibit and book. Maybe you can talk about why it's so timely.
Well, the centennial is upon us in August 2020. So the exhibition I curated addresses the history of the whole movement, if you will. I started from 1832 and I brought it up right through 1920 through 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, in order to tell a more complete story of the very important accomplishments that women achieved in 1920, but also to kind of query and problematize that achievement to see its repercussions and what exactly it did for women.
It's an amazing story for sure. And in the new book and the exhibit, we kind of hear the voices of many women who aren't that well known, at least certainly not to me, and I bet to others as well. So it was important in your mind to get their stories told.
For sure. Yeah. We at the National Portrait Gallery, we endeavor to tell the history of the United States through biography. And of course, portraiture is a great medium to do that. So I was looking for as many portraits of named women that I could find that had something to do with this movement, with, you know, suffrage, which didn't appear out of thin air. It really developed out of the abolitionist movement and the women's movement prior to that. So that's why I started the narrative as early as I did. Some historians would probably argue that I didn't start it early enough. But, you know, there's only so much space in the exhibition to put the portraits on the wall. But there's 62 named women that are featured in the exhibition, and a lot more whose names we don't know, but who we know were suffragists.
Yeah, and so 1832, why again was that the time you chose?
I found a really great journal article called from the abolitionist journal called The Liberator, by William Lloyd Garrison. He was the editor, and it was for the ladies' department, and it was the first women's column that this abolitionist newspaper had ever featured. So I was really interested to see what the ladies' column would address, and it addresses the issue of slavery and likens it to women's issues of that moment. So it was also accompanied by a very interesting illustration of an enslaved woman kneeling, asking, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" Which is taken after the British abolitionist movement. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of material to sort of unpack just from that one object, and it was published in 1832. So I thought that was a good way to start an exhibition.
Yeah, I would agree. Tell us about Seneca Falls.
Well, I like to think of Seneca Falls fondly because it's so important. It's taught in a lot of history books as the first national convention of suffragists. But it's a bit mythical because a lot of people think that's just where the suffragists, you know, poof, had an idea and and a light bulb went off in their heads, and they got together and started talking about it. But Susan B. Anthony wasn't even there. She and Elizabeth Cady Stanton didn't even meet until 1851, and of course the Seneca Falls meeting happened in 1848. So there's a lot of women's history that gets assumed and kind of mythologized, if you will. And I wanted to use the phrase unpack, but, you know, to sort of deconstruct that and to tease it out and to just understand a little bit more where the women's movement had come from prior to 1848, prior to the Seneca Falls meeting, which is very important because it was the first national meeting, but it's not where everything started.
Yeah. So what led up to that? I mean, over the years preceding it?
Oh, lots of different things. You know, women didn't have property rights. They didn't have rights over their children if they were to break up their marriages. Most of the time, divorce did not happen because women had no rights in a marriage. So there's a lot of different fights that the women were engaging in that, to our minds today, seem really unreal. It's sort of surreal that a woman couldn't control her own finances. But in those days, of course, that was the reality. So women were getting together and organizing and really trying to understand how to promote their own rights. And they learned how to do this from the abolitionist movement. So a lot of them were critical figures in the abolitionist movement, and then were taking those lessons that they learned and transferring them to a women's movement.
And this all happened, you know, the start time, 1832, that's a ways before the Civil War even took place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's, you know, people who read Phyllis Wheatley in the 18th century and other women writers, they know that these women it's not like they found their voice all of a sudden in 1832. But I wanted to pick a point that I could really address and make the exhibition as succinct as possible, even though it covers, you know, more than 80 years. And if you count 1965, more than 100 years. So it's one of those things that as a historian, you have to be a good storyteller. And that was part of the decision to make to start it in 1832.
Who were some of the leaders at the beginning?
Oh, there's numerous ones. Somebody you might not know about is Frances Harper, who was an African-American poet and writer who was very involved in the women's movement, who was, you know, thought of herself as a suffragist. And she's featured in the exhibition through a frontispiece, which is like a fancy word for the illustration of an author of a book that comes right in the beginning of the book. It was very popular in the 19th century. And so there's a lot of, I made a lot of effort to include African-American women because they're not thought to have been a part of the suffrage movement, which is absolutely incorrect. They were just as active as white women were, and they were doing their activism in their own circles, mostly through church groups, actually. So that history, you know, has yet to be told, frankly. There's not a lot of historians who have tackled that topic.
Yeah.
And so that's just one of the women that I included in the very beginning of this story.
Miss G in Madison online with us. Hi, thank you for calling. Oh, we lost her. She was, was having a comment about her mother-in-law always voted and was alive before she could vote, before she was allowed to vote.
Now those stories are really moving.
Oh, man. Well, how did the Civil War affect the suffrage movement?
The women's movement was alive and well, as I've been saying, way up through the Civil War. And it wasn't specifically suffrage that the Civil War affected. It was really women's empowerment, knowing and understanding that they could take a lead, they could have a political voice, they could manage finances, you know, because the men weren't there. So women were rising into these roles that they'd never had before. After the Civil War, in the South especially, these women were the first to lobby the White House, which is sort of surprising when you think about it.
Yeah.
They were so, the economy and their livelihoods were so devastated by the Civil War, and there were no men to speak of that to really help them, that they actually went as a group and were the first women to ever, you know, present their case to the White House. So the Civil War empowered women in these ways that some of them would probably say wasn't their choice. It was sort of out of survival, out of necessity, that they were taking in these roles that they never had imagined that they would have. But it wasn't until after the 15th Amendment that the women's movement gets really pinpointed and, you know, narrows its focus to suffrage, to voting, to gaining a political voice.
It is an amazing story, and we're going to be talking about that story and fleshing it out some more with our guest today, Kate Clark LeMay. She's a PhD, a historian, coordinating curator at the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative. And we're talking with her about the suffrage movement. There's just a remarkable book that they put together to go along with the Smithsonian's work with American Women's History Initiative, and it's a fascinating read. We will take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guest, Kate Clark LeMay, and we'll talk more about the book Votes for Women and the suffrage movement in the U.S. You stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. It took a long time for women to get the right to vote in this country. We're talking about that struggle now and the fight for equality that, you know what, in some cases still lingers today. With us, Kate Clark LeMay. She's a historian, coordinating curator of the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative, and director of the National Portrait Gallery Scholarly Center at the Smithsonian Institution. Talking to her about a new book, it's based on a current Smithsonian exhibit of the same name, Votes for Women, A Portrait of Persistence. Why do you think it took so long for women to get the right to vote? Do you have a story about women's suffrage in Wisconsin? I hope you'll join in with the conversation by calling us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kate, what were some of the reasons given for not letting women vote?
Oh, lots of reasons. They were thought to be manly. They were thought to be insane. If women were to actually speak in public in the 1830s, that was what they were called, insane. They were literally, you know, written about as if they needed to be sent to an asylum. So when women were doing these things, they were really putting a lot at risk, not just their reputations, but also, in many cases, their safety.
So early on, and then sort of the reasons changed over time a little bit.
Not really.
Not really?
Not really, no. I mean, and women to this day, we hear these echoes, you know, of that,
yeah,
that kind of tone. You know, there, if you've ever been called emotional or, you know, strident is a great word. Those types of reactions to women, especially, you know, the suffragists were confronted by that kind of reaction daily. So it's interesting as a you know, as a woman historian, to be mindful of the circles, you know, that we're sort of encountering when you look at history, and you can see the echoes to this day.
Yeah. Well, Kathy in Madison has something for us. Let's go to her. Kathy, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. So I was born in 1952. And my great grandmother was born in 1869, Della Curtis Mains. And her dad was a Civil War veteran, and she was a storyteller. And she could not vote until she was 40. And she never missed an election day. She would talk for weeks ahead about who she was going to vote for, what she was going to wear. She always dressed up in her best. And made arrangements for her son, my grandfather, to take her to the polls. And she was just, she valued this experience so highly. And I think about her every time I vote. And here was a woman who was abandoned by her husband. He was a crooked lawyer, and he went off to California and had another whole family and left her with four children. She ended up running a boarding house in Valparaiso, Indiana, and was a successful businesswoman, and then she helped my grandfather start an insurance business and worked there until he finally forced her to retire at the age of 89.
Oh.
So this was, you know, a spunky woman with tons of talent, and that's what I remember.
Oh, Kathy, what a great story. A comment from you, Kate?
Oh, well, I'm so impressed, and I think that women of this era, you know, who were like Kathy's great grandmother, I mean, they had to show this kind of grit that we admire to this day, because we know what they were up against. I mean, to have raised four children on her own, and to start a business and to do everything that she did, it seems to me like voting was almost like an homage to her own successes and to all of that, what she had been through. That's amazing.
That was an amazing story. Kathy, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. Let's go to Sarah in Green Bay next. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to know if you included the Grimke sisters in your exhibit or in your book, because I find them to be really amazing people growing up in Charleston with a privileged background, how they would forgo all of that and risk their lives. I mean, it threats against them and to pursue women's rights. And then they were originally abolitionists, and then when they started to speak out for women's rights, the abolitionists kind of kicked them out of their movement. And it's curious to me that when they decided on suffrage for African Americans, they did not include women. And I wonder if the if they had pushed for women's rights at the same time as the anti-slavery and black rights, if it would have been more successful.
Mm. Yeah, those are big questions. Thanks for bringing up the Grimke sisters. And as Sarah pointed out, you know, they were radical. I mean, they define the word radical because they were born in the South Carolina and left because Angelina, you know, became a Quaker, and Sarah moved up to Philadelphia to join her. Angelina did have a family, and I borrowed a beautiful daguerreotype of Angelina with her husband, Theodore Weld, and their children, and it's from the University of Michigan. So thank you to the Clements Library for loaning that object to us. It's an outstanding portrait. I wanted to picture the sisters, but I also wanted to pay homage to what they had written and what they had done. So I included an 1837 publication that Angelina Grimke wrote, an appeal to the women of nominally free states. It was actually a publication of her speech that she gave at one of the suffrage conventions. And then I also features a book by Sarah Grimke as well. You know, I think that the Grimke sisters, you know, as abolitionists, there was such a question about the 15th Amendment and why it gave African American men the right to vote, and why not black women or, you know, women at all. And that was ratified in 1870, and it really split the movement. And that's when you start to see some of the most racist comments made by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, because they were outraged that these formerly enslaved men were getting the right to vote before educated white women, you know, never mind black women who were also formerly enslaved. So there's this whole kind of ugly part of the history that I think is important to shed light on and to sort of recognize as, you know, part of the history.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thanks for pointing that out.
And maybe at this point, before we go back to the phones, and we'll get to the phones again, but talk about the book itself. It's a beautiful book with some powerful writing and wonderful photography, photos, and of the women that you feature.
Thank you, Larry. I mean, I feel like I lost a few years of my life over this book. It was a big project. It was wonderful to put together. I was fortunate to work with some amazing scholars, including Lisa Tetro, Susan Goodyear, and Martha S. Jones. Because Princeton University Press worked with us, we were able to make it scholarly, but also a general history. So I feel like there's something in there for everyone. If you want to get into the footnotes, you can. Yeah. Or if you want just a general history, you know, that's there too. And I think you pointed out some of the best part. One of the best parts is that it's richly illustrated, and
yeah.
So it includes every single object that I curated in the exhibition, and it's truly a beautiful book. Well, I'm so proud of it.
It is really beautiful. I was really struck by the cover right from the start. You talk about art and publicity, and that was a little later, 1910 or 11, somewhere in there,
mm-hmm.
to galvanize people. And
the
cover, describe the cover.
It's an arts and crafts poster by Bertha M. Boyer. It was made in 1910, and it was actually published and won a California state suffrage contest for, you know, the most engaging poster that you know, addressed the suffrage issue. And so the version I have is printed. It's a lithograph, so it's printed in a series. And so it's from 1913. It's one of the first prints of this poster. But it's a woman who's holding a scroll. She's wearing a beautiful long robe,
yeah,
and it's yellow, and her head is silhouetted and haloed by the sun, and she almost is like a precursor to the Golden Gate Bridge, because her form itself is in between these two sort of mountainous landscapes. It's very specific to California in its aesthetic, but the scroll that she's holding says "Votes for Women," so it's a very quiet, very sort of quiet tones, I guess.
Understated.
Understated. Thank you. Understated, and yet it's a powerful statement because it's so effective visually, and it speaks to California. It speaks to that moment. It's all about whether or not they'll change their state constitution and allow women to vote.
It's beautiful. Lillian in Brown County, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for waiting, Lillian. What's on your mind?
I have a comment about a PBS BBC documentary about suffragettes in England. And, you know, we had our suffragette movement here, but we weren't the only country that was fighting to get the vote. And that's really interesting story, as well as our own. And then 1970, my former husband informed me, this was an educated man, that a faithful wife votes the way her husband does.
Kate, the comment?
Lillian is, she's from a generation, and women couldn't even open a bank account in the 70s in some states without the permission of their husbands. Women in the 1960s could not hold a job if they got married. We're talking about the women's movement. That's the second wave, so to speak, you know, from the 60s and 70s, and she was right there witnessing it, and it's pretty powerful to hear, you know, these stories, because it reminds us it's not that far off. It's not that far away from long ago.
Yeah.
That we were achieving some of the things we really just take for granted today. And just one comment about the British suffragette movement. They just celebrated their centennial because they achieved the right to vote in 1918. And so
I think
to compare the two.
And I think you talk about it in your book a little bit, that the women here borrowed a little, perhaps, from what was going on in Europe, the women there and their
tactics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Larry, you're so right. I'm glad you picked up on that. Alice Paul went to get her graduate degree in England and was taken in by their movement and worked with Pankhurst and was picketing and doing all of the nonviolent strategies that the British suffragettes were employing. Paul, of course, is a Quaker, so she's not going to start throwing bricks through a window, right? But she's going to protest. And so she learned those strategies, and then she brought them back to the United States. And when she started what's now referred to as the National Women's Party, they embraced those strategies, and they were the first to ever march on Washington. It was the first nonviolent, I should say, march on Washington, because back in the 1880s, Coxey's army came over from Ohio with guns and basically terrorized everybody. But the women in 1913 were the first nonviolent protesters. And it's pretty fantastic to learn these incredibly important firsts that women made. And yet we don't really know much about that.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about Belva Ann Lockwood, as a matter of fact. She was the first woman to campaign for the presidency.
She was the second.
Second.
You're right. She was the first to campaign. She was the second woman to run for president. So the first woman to run for president on a third party ticket was Victoria Woodhull. But she was put into jail, so she couldn't campaign. And then you're right. So I'm sorry for, you know, erroneously correcting you. Belva Ann Lockwood was the first to actually campaign. And she did. And she used what I call a rebus ribbon in my exhibition, and it features her name through pictures, so that illiterate voters could spell, you know, sound out her name. So there's a bell, there's the letter V, there's a pile, there's a lock, and then there's a pile of wood in the ribbon. Pretty cool.
Carol in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting, and it resonates, because my father, I remember sitting at the kitchen table and him saying that not only should my mother vote the way that he votes, but also when the kids grow up, they should too. But anyways, I wanted to mention a book that I'm reading. It's written by Deborah Brennigan. She went to high school with me in Brown Deer, graduated in 1978. And it's about Fanny Fern. It's historical fiction, but it's listed under biography. And I don't know if you'd ever heard of Fanny Fern, but she was her real name was, that was her pen name. Her real name was Sarah Willis. And the story takes place during this same time where women were very oppressed and controlled by their husbands. And so she was a writer who wrote newspaper articles and did not fit in very well with the times because of her outspoken ways, and suffered greatly. And it's just a very illuminating book about a woman that I had never heard of. And so I wanted to mention it to your guest and also put a plug in for this book. It's called Shame the Devil.
Shame the Devil, yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, it's funny because 70% of the historians out there are men. And it might even be 80%. And I think that women like Fanny Fern who, as Carol mentions, you know, is this incredibly important author, has been overlooked. And I know that we have these movements, like the New York Times is doing these obituaries within a series called Overlooked, and it's to highlight women that were overlooked. But I do think that part of the problem is that those who write the history are writing about what they are interested in. And if that's a bunch of men, people like Fanny Fern are going to be overlooked. And that's why the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative is so important, because we are tapping the nation's collections and really pouring a lot of effort and organization and time into deploying them and making them digitally available, doing exhibitions like the one I just curated, Votes for Women, the catalog that you like so much, Larry, things like that, you know, will hopefully help us reset a new course and start putting women's history out there on equal terms to how men's history has been treated.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking about an excellent Wisconsin author, Jennifer Cheverini, who has written several historical fictions, but they always feature women. And I think she's done a lot just to raise awareness of some of the things that women have achieved through history. So you might check some of her books out sometime, Jennifer Cheverini.
Great.
Nancy and Madison, your turn.
Yes, I wanted to be sure that this got mentioned. Wisconsin has already celebrated the centennial of its ratification of the amendment, women's right to vote. Resolution, maybe it was in Washington, had been passed, but then 34 states had to ratify for it to become law. And Wisconsin, there was a funny race to be the first, and Wisconsin managed to be the first in 1919.
Yes.
The exact date. But there is a wonderful exhibit about that that continues in the Wisconsin State Capitol under the rotunda about Wisconsin's suffrage movement and the their passing of that ratifying the amendment. I recommend it to everyone in Madison and everyone who comes to Madison.
Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it. We were first there.
Yeah, no, Wisconsin was the first state. I mean, that's a pretty fantastic claim that Wisconsin can make. It was June 10th of 1919. And, you know, it's interesting, if you look at the map that was produced by suffragists to demonstrate, you know, where women could vote, there's a whole bunch of states that never ratified the 19th Amendment. And so they're mostly on the Eastern Seaboard. So it's very interesting to think if the other states hadn't ratified this amendment, like Wisconsin, you know, women in Delaware would not be voting, or women in Alabama would not be voting. It's pretty fantastic. Thank you for mentioning that, Nancy.
And Kate, thank you so much for being with us today. The book Votes for Women is a fascinating read, and I thank you so much for doing the work on this and for curating the wonderful exhibit there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Kate Clark LeMay, and the book is called Votes for Women. I hope you have a chance to see it. It's wonderfully written and illustrated. Appreciate having her with us. Tomorrow is bike day on the show, so we'll talk about how to buy the right bike and then a book about an extraordinary cyclist, Major Taylor, America's first black sports hero. Stay with us.